It is Saturday, September 24th, 2011. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI.
It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today's theme is by Dave Patera. Thank you very much for the theme. If you'd like to participate, I'm making music for Geek Speak. We'd love to have it. Go find out more at geekspeak.org. In the second half of the show, we'll welcome you to join the conversation. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Alex Lias. He's an application security analyst. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, Lyle.
And Mr. Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie.
Good morning.
And Mr. Ben Jaffe, freelance media guy, sometimes Stanford instructor. Howdy.
Hey there. How are you doing, Lyle?
Good. Quite well. Thank you. I think since Alex is so on top of it and actually has all his news in there first, we'll start with you. What's up with Netflix?
Netflix. Well, a lot of people have heard that Netflix has made some changes to their product lines, some of the changes going on with their stock. It was also recently announced that Netflix is going to be splitting up entirely the DVD and the online service, and not just as products like they announced before, but as two completely separate services. So
like different companies, kind of like Palm.
Different companies, but I think more importantly to the consumer, not going to be integrated. Which means you basically have to manage things separately. You got to have your DVDs. They might as well be two different services.
Why are they doing this?
There's a lot. That's a big question. That,
from what I've been hearing, it's licensing issues, having to deal with the various production houses.
Mm-hmm.
When they have to make a deal with them, they're saying, okay, we're going to have here's these movies. When there was DVDs, it was pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward because we've had rentals.
We've
DVDs
already had
for,
history of that.
Yeah.
Concert, mm-hmm. Sure.
As I started streaming online, suddenly you have more and more people shifting over to that. And so having those two models where there's some DVD and there's some online, and how do you determine how many of this particular user is watching? And I think it's because their streaming became so popular, it actually started pushing them over some thresholds of their license agreements.
Yeah. I still don't understand why you'd make it two different corporations. Why not just do different divisions that compete with each other? I'm assuming there's some reason to do it from a profit and loss perspective. But maybe it really is just, I want to make a legal relationship with this entity versus this entity.
There
really
I think it's a legal thing.
Hmm. I would assume that shareholders are splitting. It's a public company.
It'd be nice. Even if they're separating it legally, if there was some sort of way of having a single interface with services, just partnerships effectively.
Yeah.
Mm. But because it's just going to be annoying to have to manage it all separately.
Are you currently, with your Netflix, are you currently having DVDs too?
Yeah, I have both.
Why are you doing both? Because some movies...
Some movies aren't available. Yeah, and plus, it's really... I like being able to watch HD on Blu-ray sometimes, so...
Yeah, which you can't do online.
One thing that actually bothered me a little bit about it, my sister has Netflix, and she forwarded this email that they sent her as a subscriber, and it basically said, sorry, we haven't been transparent about all of these changes and the pricing increases and stuff. Here it is. This is the honest truth. This is the reason. And they didn't talk about any licensing things, and the cases that they made in the email as far as why they are making all these changes were not very compelling. So it was a little bit frustrating to see.
Well,
Netflix.
Are you inferring that they're lying in that email?
I'm inferring
thing,
that they're not telling the full truth. That they're not saying the real reasons we're doing this are because of licensing.
Because I
got to
say that the licensing thing is an assumption and something that's being whispered about. It doesn't sound strong enough to me.
Well, not even whispered. definitely posted.
In the blogosphere.
I don't know. My assumption is that they're not telling the full truth because of two things. One, the case that they make on their own isn't very compelling to me. The case that they make in the email and the explanations, and two, because they're a corporation, and corporations are known to lie all the time to everybody. So, why? What's the reason to trust them? I guess by default.
Yeah, one thing I could say is that the market share or the market was not very happy with them. Their stock, I think, dropped like 20% that day.
Yeah, it was huge.
Now, are they a global company? They provide the services to all over the place?
Not everywhere, but they are global. Yeah. They have services outside of the U.S. So.
Interesting. Speaking of outside the U.S., Miles, what's going on in Western Europe?
Well, we've talked about on the show, the U.S. just is kind of falling behind in terms of broadband speeds.
Oh, yeah.
You got countries like South Korea, Japan, France, many Scandinavian countries that are beating us. Turns out that Eastern Europe is beating us now. They're pushing ahead like gangbusters, and we're still kind of plugging along. And it's not to say that I don't have a reasonably fast connection, at least for what I've been used to, but it's nothing like what people are seeing overseas. And basically what we're looking at here is also what is the average over the entire country of people that have internet connection. Mm-hmm. And so this coming from Ars Technica, there's a group called Pando Networks, and they have their global game download report. And what they're finding is that, for example, South Korea has an average download speed of 17.62 megabits per second,
mm-hmm.
which incidentally is faster than mine. Their average is faster than mine. and you have, you know, Romania at 15, you know, and change.
Does this mean that this company basically has a lot of downloads that are taking place? And so they're able to look at the IP traffic, where those downloads are happening, how fast they go, and that's how they're assuming their
mm-hmm.
speeds.
Mm-hmm.
So if there was really sophisticated proxying going on, that would ruin that.
I don't know their methodology, okay. So I can't speak
so
to
we'll
that.
Just go with the numbers they've got, but
right.
There could be a problem with it.
Yeah, so okay. Romania, 15 megabit, Bulgaria, 12.9, Lithuania, 11.7.
What is U.S.'s average?
The United States, 4.93.
Just
under 5 megabit.
Okay.
And Great Britain, 4.79, just under 5 megabit.
And what's like average DSL speed here in the U.S.?
DSL speed?
Yeah.
I don't know what the average is. I know that it ranges from anywhere from the entry level of like 768K kilobits per second to 6 megabits per second. It's the fastest I've seen for DSL.
Right.
I think most people I talk to who still have DSL, they're like in the 2 to 3 megabit range.
No, right.
Not
3 is common,
pay
yeah.
the high, so...
Yeah.
They're kind of in that middle range.
So a DSL line is still, DSL's maximum speed is right up at the average in most of these countries, or below.
Oh, well below. Yeah.
I mean, that's the interesting thing, of course, is that a lot of our service in the U.S. is DSL based.
Yeah, I was saying like South Korea, Romania, those countries are equivalent to the typical cable download speeds.
Do you remember, Miles, we were on air when we first started hearing about DSL. Do you remember this? Even those early discussions about
first
speed?
Heard about DSL?
Yeah.
We were doing no, because
yeah,
we had DSL
long
when?
Before.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, then I guess I just was talking with you about DSL then.
When I say we, I mean Alex and myself. We actually used to share an apartment in San Diego.
Yep.
You had DSL then?
And yeah, that was 97.
Okay, so 96, I just used to have geek. I used
96,
to,
yeah, 96, 97.
I guess I used to have geeky conversations. You weren't even born, right?
Yeah,
I guess
I'm from San Diego.
I just have always had geeky discussions about this kind of thing. I just didn't happen to have a radio show.
Yeah, we had our Roadrunner cable modem.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Maybe.
I remember as it came out being just really shocked about its speed potential because, of course, the idea of how fast a modem could be, 56K, was it, man.
Well, 56K is how fast a modem could go,
yeah.
But 52 was like the limit that the U.S. phone lines would allow.
Right. That's great. Anyway.
And then in difficulty, you'd get, you know, 40.
Well, let's talk about other improvements. I'm hoping that there's other things in the world that aren't depressing, like the U.S. having such bad bandwidth. Anything good in the health space there, Alex?
Sure. Actually, there's been some recent, news that's come up regarding, let me frame it this way. There's basically a man that was living in Berlin, and he became pretty much world famous for being the first and so far the only person to have basically had his HIV cured, essentially. In his case, he also had developed leukemia, and so he was going through lots of blood transfusions, and I guess the primary donor for his blood had a mutated version of a particular, receptor that the virus uses in order to kind of invade cells. Mm-hmm. And that
it's the immunity to the Black Plague, right? That's coming from northern Scandinavia.
I haven't heard that it was that. That's interesting. So yeah, basically
something along those lines.
Yeah. They've been doing research into this, in terms of doing gene therapy to kind of, I guess, go with the same effect and the same approach trying to
modify someone's cells so that it doesn't have a receptor.
Exactly. And so there's been a lot of promise, and they're saying that they may be looking at a cure in the near term.
Wow. But this would be with modifying people's cells?
Yeah. Which is a whole other area of kind of scariness.
Kind of creepy, yeah.
Well, no, we've been talking about, folks have been talking about gene therapy for some time, and this is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting because gene therapy is clearly would be very beneficial. Get rid of diseases, you get sick, it's wonderful. But at the same time, when you start talking about modifying foods, genetically engineering foods, that same idea is a lot scarier to people, especially in the U.S. and in England.
Well,
I find it curious that it's the same basic, you know, issues and revolves around it. There can be mutations you don't know about. You're modifying the genome. Who knows what happens?
Quote Dr. Don, talk about, someone has cancer and I want to handle it the natural way. She's like, no, you don't, because the natural way is to die.
Right.
Your chemotherapy and all these things that are unnatural are to keep us from doing the natural thing, which is to die. So if you have someone say, okay, well, you can either have, you know, AIDS and have to manage that or have any health complications you can do something unnatural.
Of course, most people that get to the level of AIDS at this point in the U.S. take the cocktail and get back down to HIV positive status or barely sensible status without really having full, you know, the immune system is actually in strong strength after the cocktail. So to some degree, we've fixed
with some
it
side
from
effects.
Some
perspective. Yeah, there's still side effects
probably,
to the drugs.
Yeah, and there's probably, of course, a shorter lifespan as well. But this would be not just not being affected by the virus anymore, but basically your cells wouldn't be receptive, so therefore the virus wouldn't be reproducing in your system, and it would die out, and you wouldn't be contagious anymore.
Right.
Kind of impressive. So if it can work, that's awesome. I wouldn't want the treatment, though, right now. Get leukemia, lose all your ability to produce red blood cells, get new blood cells so that someone has a mutation, and you're done. It's like, yay.
That's not really the treatment as much as it was the method of discovery.
The other thing is that that patient is probably susceptible again now because now that the bone marrow, hopefully, in the system has grown back, it doesn't have that, isn't reproducing those. But we shouldn't get in this medical
show. I still think this is very amazing, though. Just 30 years, we've gone from this horrible scourge that was basically a death sentence to manage it and you can live a little bit longer to now it's kind of like diabetes. You just have to take this medicine on a regular basis. And
it's pretty interesting. Well, let's talk about other interesting stuff. Let's talk about some tech, shall we?
We shall. So some University of Michigan researchers have recently proposed a new way of managing power on smartphones, which can actually increase battery life, not by increasing the size or the capacity of the batteries, but by decreasing the amount of power that's used. And their proof of concept system that they made, it's called E-Mili or Energy Minimizing Idle Listening. So basically the idea is that the cell phone will go into what they call subconscious mode, which I kind of think is cute. And it'll kind of, in subconscious mode, it'll kind of listen for packets that are coming in. And then when it gets these packets, it'll wake back up and then it'll receive all the packets at full speed. So it actually, this system actually slows down the clock speed on the chip of the phone, of the card in the phone, to like 1/16 its normal frequency, which means it uses presumably 1/16 the power, maybe almost 1/16 the power. And then, of course, it kicks back up to full speed when something comes in.
Actually, your gains will probably be more than that. As you put in more power, you get a diminishing return. Mm-hmm. So dropping the power rate will probably give you more than 1/16 increase.
Yeah. Well, it says here that they saw battery life extended by up to 54%.
Not bad.
That's a lot, right?
Yeah.
And
I'm curious, this would work if your phone wasn't doing tasks. So your MP3 player is not playing, your map system's not tracking your location. There's a lot of things that have to be turned off for this to function. Or is it that it just everything will be a lot slower and it's okay?
Well, I guess it depends on what you're doing, because the things that definitely suck energy the most are the chip on the phone itself and also the display. The display sucks most of the power.
The antennas too.
Oh, yeah. The antenna and the chips and all of that. Like, the connection to the cell network. And that's kind of what we're talking about here.
That's
and
really
so,
cool, because, of course, you do have to normally, traditionally, have a cell phone when it's even, you know, not on, not live screen, whatever.
Yeah.
It still has to be communicating with the cell tower.
Yeah.
And so this is just slowing that down, hopefully enough that you'll still get your phone call.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it works, apparently.
That's great.
However, there are a lot of changes you need to make to, I mean, you need to make a change to the chip firmware as well as a software change in order to be able to get this stuff. But it is, theoretically, it's backwards compatible. So if they start testing it and rolling it out, that's pretty cool.
Do you know if it's a BIOS level update or if it's a...
I would assume it's a BIOS level update.
Yeah. I'm always not curious about cell phones because you never really update the... I mean, you update the BIOS, it's not called that, right? I mean,
yeah.
iPhone firmware. Example, it's firmware.
Yeah, so,
right,
so it's firmware.
Yeah, but it's being updated kind of on the fly. Yeah. Like a... I'm assuming the Android's the same way. You can upgrade your version of OS at the same time.
And you can update other things like the code that handles all the radio transmissions and things like that. Like when you crack your phone to root it and install CyanogenMod or something like that, you have to install a different patch on the radio.
In this case, what Ben's talking about is hacking into your phone so that you can install software that's not managed by someone else. But
which is actually okay with Google. It's not okay with Apple. So if you have an iOS device, you can still do it, but it's not. They don't let you do it easily. You know,
was a court case that said that it is legal to jailbreak your own phone.
Yeah. Well, Apple still doesn't like it. But I mean, when I jailbroke mine, there was this nice little friendly dialogue box that Google popped up that said, hey, just so you know, you're jailbreaking your phone.
That's great.
And no more warranty, you know, blah, 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 blah. But I mean, so when I'm using the GPS navigation in my phone, it sucks so much battery, but it's not because of the GPS. It's because of the display. Because when I'm using it on my phone, my display is always on,
right?
You know, and it just sucks all the battery out. So presumably, this is my assumption, that they're talking about users who don't use their phone for things like that. They use their phone for receiving phone calls. So their screen is always off.
Are you using the GPS on foot or in car?
In car.
So, but you just plug in, right?
What?
You just plug in then, right?
Well, yeah. Actually, I keep losing chargers to my device. So I just bought a new one
feeling.
And everything.
Cables
it's so frustrating.
Yeah. It's funny that you brought up that story. I didn't realize you were going to be doing that. Is that... There's another company is doing something similar to this, but a different avenue. NVIDIA, with their Tegra 3 chip, is working with a multi-core chip, and it's marketed as a four-core system, but they have a fifth core that it's a completely different die set that's made for a CPU die to go very, very efficient.
I see. Right.
Whereas the other four are your typical, and they can try to do the power management, but as soon as you go into a slower mode, you just drop off the main cores and put in this other one.
I hope they call it the subconscious processor. I love that idea.
This is your subconscious.
Yeah, they call it a phantom or a zombie, or I don't know.
It makes a lot of sense, because of course you want that speed and ability so you can have high quality content and fast games.
Right, the Tegra 3 chips have been able to do like high def HDMI.
But most of the time the phone is almost in an idle state. You really want it as low as possible. It's a great idea to split it up.
Miles, I'm not sure that zombies are all that efficient. Like we were talking about the efficiency of this core. I don't know.
How often do they have to eat? They eat a lot.
Competitive.
But they walk all jerkily and everything. That's not a very good
use. You wouldn't want to be as your constant companion, but they're going to be there with you all the time. They're going to be with you until the end of your days.
Let me just mute them there.
Yeah. Keep going, guys. Didn't stop.
Understandably. Rightfully so.
Let's talk a little bit about... Miles, what's going on in space? Because Ben didn't do a space story. He normally does one, but so you have to fill in.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Water. Think of water. We say, oh, well, the Earth has a whole bunch of water. I mean, most of the Earth is covered in water.
Mm-hmm. We're made of water.
And we're made of water. We're ugly bags of mostly water. And we are always very excited to learn that we find a little bit of water on Mars. We find a little bit of water on the moon, like these little pockets. And we find out that Io has these possible oceans, liquid oceans. Oh, my goodness. Turns out that's not even close to how much water there is out
in
there.
Space.
The largest body of water in existence actually exists in space.
Where?
We normally think of space as being a very dry, deserty place. But
yes.
But around a black hole, 12 billion light years away.
Oh, just next door.
There is a vapor of water that's enough to supply an entire planet's worth of water for every person on Earth 20,000 times over.
What?
I love when you get big numbers, you try to make sense of it. You're like, okay, everyone gets a planet of water. Okay, 20,000. Oh, that's a lot of water.
Everybody gets 20,000 Earths of water.
Now, this is far
enough
away.
All 7 billion of us.
this is far enough away that's not...
Can we just go out and get this?
I mean, is this all now consumed by the black hole? Because it's orbiting the black hole?
It's because the black hole is releasing a huge amount of hydrogen and oxygen, some basic elements out, and under high energy.
Yeah.
And they are combining, and it's just collecting together.
That's really cool.
Big glass of water.
Yeah, collecting together in much the same way that water vapor collects together. But yeah.
You know, I think the ice pirates would be pretty happy about that.
Nice. Good. I like all the references today. Good.
So to give the number according to NASA, NASA refers to it as, quote, 140 trillion times all the water in the world's oceans.
140 trillion.
Yeah, so just to, you know, to get it in a different number that you can't possibly comprehend.
Oh, my God.
So if with our own galaxy, the Milky Way, we have 400 billion stars, give or take. If each of those stars had 10 planets that were each as had as much water as the Earth, that's still only 4 trillion. Planets worth of water.
You know, as a geek, I run into this issue
as opposed
a lot.
To 140 trillion times all the water which is on this planet.
Trying to understand numbers greater than
this water
500, we'll say, it's just really, really difficult. And once you get over a million, actually, when you get to a million, Harry Potter, all 7 books, has 1 million words in it. And it takes a really long time to read Harry Potter. I read pretty fast.
Wait, there's a million words?
1 million, a little over 1 million words in Harry Potter. 1 million's a really big number, even though we throw it around all the time.
I think, are you sure about that number?
I'm pretty sure.
I think that's a lot more words than there are.
Really?
Dun, 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 dun.
Have you read book 4?
Good, very good, man.
And another way to think of big numbers, you know, the average U.S. human lifetime is... somewhere around 2.25 billion seconds.
I have the numbers for you, Lyle.
So you can think of billion as just like that's how many seconds in your lifetime.
Right.
2 billion.
Yeah.
Oof.
Or, wow. You know, 2.25 billion, 2.3 billion.
But you
billion.
Sleep through half and of it.
How many words?
Well,
is that the number? What was the number?
It's a little over a million, actually.
Wow.
Yeah. The longest book has 257,000. That's the Order of the Phoenix book.
Wow.
7, 6, 5, book 5? Book 5? That must be wrong. Book 5 wasn't the longest one, was it?
Yeah. Well, so Alex, or was it? Book 4. In space, what's going on?
Book 4 was long, book 5 was long.
All right, so anyway, as far as continuing on with the whole space idea.
Yes.
After we announced that GeekSpeak is...
Oh, you want to do that?
KUSP.
You want to help me with it?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't need help, sorry. Hey, GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Dr. Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in handcrafted dentistry from start to finish, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. Information at 423-2447. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. This is GeekSpeak. Anybody have a geek bit?
Yes. Well,
okay, Miles.
Ben has one as well.
Okay, I want to
come
on.
We both perk up.
Quick.
Quick?
Quick.
Happy birthday, Jim Henson.
Awesome.
75th birthday today.
Yay, Jim, you're awesome.
Wait, if he were still alive.
If he was still alive. Well, it's still his birthday.
It's still his birthday.
Right.
The sun has gone around 75 times, roughly.
But do we talk about, like, it's George Washington's birthday, and he would be 230. I have a couple of videos.
Is that why you've got a Muppet with you?
It's not a Muppet.
Oh.
It's a stuffed a stuffed animal.
Right. Go on.
It's a little rabbit.
I have a couple of videos I'm going to be putting up on the website after the show.
On geekspeak.org.
On geekspeak.org. One of them is the view from Earth if the various planets were the distance of the moon from us. Ooh, so you can see how big they would be in the sky, just to give you some...
That would be big.
Oh, yeah, wow.
The other video I have is a flyover, a time-lapse flyover from the International Space Station, what it's like to fly over planet Earth. And so you see like all the cities that are lit up, and you see the sunrise.
Awesome.
So if you want to be in awe, put on the Edward Scissorhands soundtrack and then play that video full screen. You'll just be like, whoa, there's so much lightning on this planet.
Really?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, and just because it's Geek Speak.
All right, Geek
Speak. I'm also going to post up the rules for three-way chess.
Good.
And a picture.
It's about time.
Yeah, and the picture of a chessboard that is made for three players.
Is the board square?
No.
Okay, good.
Anyone have a 3D chess
board? Four-person chess is a square board.
Yeah, that was in Star Trek.
You can call us with questions and comments about technology. You can join the conversation. Ask us anything you'd like. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. And I'm going to do that again, nice and slow for you. But please feel free to call about anything you'd like. If you'd like to add to our discussion, comment on the news you've heard already, mention something else, we have phone lines available for your call. Again, the phone number is 1-800-655-5877. As we're waiting for that to process, please, Alex, what else is going on in space?
All right, so... basically, some more information has come out, recently, where they're questioning, or actually thinking that there may be some additional issues in terms of sending people to Mars, such that their vision may be overly impaired by the time they get there. It's come out that some of the astronauts from the ISS mission have been somewhat, I guess. Not really being forthcoming that their vision has been declining a bit.
Hmm.
And it's been, the astronauts have basically been having a disproportionate decline in their vision.
Is it space cataracts?
I don't know if it's space cataracts.
It's because they don't have gravity to shape their eyeballs.
Because they keep on looking at the sun.
No, people talk about, astronauts talk about, they'll have blinders on when they're trying to sleep. At their night, even though daytime is different, and you'll see these pinpoints of light because you are being bombarded by particles. Mm. So you'll see these little flash shows, even when your eyes are closed and you have your eyes covered in a blinder.
I'm glad the planet has a magnetosphere. That's really nice.
There could be all sorts of real causes for it. I haven't really gotten into the details about what causes it, but the whole idea, is interesting, especially for the idea of having humans in space for any long period of time.
Yeah.
That could be an issue. I mean, it's understanding the specifics as to the cause is going to be obviously a big factor.
So human beings have been in space for a while. So why are we only hearing about it now?
Well, a lot of them being active duty astronauts have just not wanting to come out and admit my vision's going bad, because that will pretty much take them off the mission list. Mm-hmm.
But you'd think they test them.
But also with the ISS, astronauts have been out much longer than they ever have before. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, mission of Mars would be a long time.
So this blurry vision kind of thing, is it the same kind of degradation you see in humans as they get older, just faster? Or is it something like totally new? Not sure.
Yeah, not really sure.
Just not so good on the vision thing. Ben? Ben, what are you doing? Are you watching something else? The SGU?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Best failed segment ever. Sorry. see, we can see each other and give each other confusing hand gestures.
What is the SGU?
SGU, Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, a fantastic podcast about science and critical thinking, skepticism. They cover a lot of really fantastic stories. They also have really great interviews with...
really great people.
Really great people, yeah. And we had Stephen Novella, who hosts the SGU, on a couple years ago, actually. Mm-hmm. Well, they are, as we speak, doing a 24-hour show. 24-hour Skeptic's Guide to the Universe live video and audio broadcast on Justin TV.
It's really interesting. They're actually going to... They have a bunch of content. They're also going to people's other places that people are watching them and kind of saying hi. And
yeah.
Really kind of cool.
And they're also Skyping in really interesting interviews from all around the planet as the sun... they're following the sun around the planet for the 24 hours.
All right, so the 24-hour SKU is happening right now. I'm glad I didn't know about this last night, or I would have been watching all night.
Yeah, I know. Actually, that was a problem for me.
I forgot about it.
But they are going until, I believe it is 7 p.m. or 8 p.m. They have about six hours tonight, left. Yeah. So, you know, if you want to watch it after
what's
Geek
the website?
If you go to the skeptics.org or the skepticsguide.org.
Okay. And you can go there, you can find out about it from geekspeak.org, as you can everything we talk about today on GeekSpeak. Don from Santa Cruz, welcome to GeekSpeak. What's up?
A few minutes ago, you were talking about black holes.
Yes,
and I need to back up in order to ask my question, okay?
Uh-huh.
When we first heard about black holes, they said they were black because they even swallowed light.
Yes, they do.
Then they started, black holes do emit something. They emit X-rays, trillion mile long lines that come out of the center of black holes.
Now, on either side, yeah.
A few minutes ago, you said...
Miles said it, actually, but go on, yes.
...oxygen, and that under certain conditions that can combine to create water.
Yes.
My question is...
How is that possible?
...the black hole emitting anything...
Well, first off, let's talk about the event horizon of
a
black hole.
The event horizon of a black hole being that point where light can no longer escape.
And nothing can escape.
Right.
Nothing does escape.
Right. However, before you get to that event horizon, things are still moving, are being accelerated at a very fast rate. Mm-hmm. And so you end up with, before you get to the event horizon, before you get to that point, there is matter being sucked in, but it's kind of going in orbit, I guess would be the best way to describe it.
Yeah.
And being pulled all around and being torn apart.
Yeah.
And it happens to get an escape velocity as it's going around through.
Now, the other thing that, of course, is Hawking radiation, which kind of talks about how black holes will eventually kind of evaporate, that came mm-hmm. idea. And then it has to do with quantum fluctuations in space. So you have small particles all the time in a quantum level being created and collapse back on each other all the time. When you're on at an event horizon location, one of those particle sides will get pulled out, and you'll be left with a new particle. That's the Hawking radiation that causes those X-ray beams, I believe.
Uh-huh.
But that same idea, I haven't read the story, and I knew that we didn't have a real understanding of why there was oxygen, hydrogen being created. But I'm assuming it has to do with high velocity particle bombardment. You can think of it the black hole around it as a giant accelerator, right? That's
right.
Slamming things together. So any kind of particles that get hit.
Slamming things together and also splitting them apart.
Right. So let's say a few hundred thousand iron particles come in and get hit. They're going to actually break into smaller particles. And one of the smaller, the smallest two atoms that are stable are hydrogen and oxygen. Yeah.
And so release a whole bunch of energy, which is going to either increase the velocity, alter the trajectory.
Heat things up, yeah. So we didn't get into that, but... No, you're totally right. Nothing's coming out of the black hole. It's about the boundary of the black hole. Thank you so much for your focus on our dialogue.
One clarification?
Sure.
It sounded like what you're saying is that these are events that are just above the swallow point.
Yes.
Swallow point can also mean the distance of a solar system above or something
really
like that.
Yeah. Different things happen in different places. Thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, pretty much any time you get anywhere near a black hole, really weird things happen.
And you get a lot of spaghetti.
And you don't have to... Yeah, right.
Italian meals.
If you're interested in black holes and what would happen if you fall into a black hole, Google Neil deGrasse Tyson spaghettification. And he has a great talk on it about how you're extruded through space. And
yeah, you're not alive for it at that point, but you know.
Spaghettification is actually a real scientific term too. That's kind of fun.
Miles, do you want to introduce line two?
Introduce line two.
From Santa Cruz, California?
Kareem? Yes. Line two, Kieran from Santa Cruz.
Hi. I called a long time ago. I said I was 12, and I'm 13 because my birthday passed. But
Happy birthday.
I called in about putting a Ubuntu on a Windows computer that got a virus.
Yes.
It wouldn't let me log in.
Yes. And you installed Ubuntu? Have you installed Ubuntu?
No.
Okay.
Because I made the disk on a MacBook and it didn't. And I tried with DVD minus R's and it didn't work. It kept saying, "And put in a new DVD. The computer has written it wrong."
Okay. So and it didn't. You didn't have a successful creation of a disk. It sounds like. You know, if you're still working on making the Ubuntu, you can, of course, you can actually contact Ubuntu and have a disk sent sent to you that's bootable. They still do that program? I think they do.
I believe so. I'll go double check.
Yeah.
Well,
but let's say you've got a stable computer environment. Was there something else you wanted to be able to do?
Well, I got DVD plus R's, and then it worked, and so I put it on the Ubuntu on it, mm-hmm. and now I put it in the Windows computer, and I can't figure out how to get it to boot from the disk in the Windows computer.
Okay. Well, in a Windows machine, you need to enter the BIOS to make sure that the CD is chosen. Now, this is assuming that the CD or DVD that's bootable is actually functional, and it might not be. So to test that, what you need to do is actually choose the DVD or CD to choose it to boot. Most of the time, computers are kind of set up by default to boot off the CD if there's an operating system on there, but that can be disabled. To get in there, you have to get into the BIOS. Alex, do you have a Windows machine? Do you remember how to get in the BIOS? It depends on the computer.
Sometimes it's delete, sometimes it's F2, sometimes it's F1, sometimes it's F8. But it'll tell you when you're booting. If you read the screen really carefully, and you might have to reboot a couple times to be able to catch it. But then press the key when it tells you that you can press the key, and just hold it down until you're in the BIOS.
And when you're in a BIOS, it's going to be kind of like a text-based black screen with text-based stuff on it, maybe sometimes a white screen. And you have to go around to what you're looking for is the boot order. Now, careful in the BIOS, because if you do mess up in the BIOS, your machine will be very non-functional. So you want to walk around through that menu item until you find the boot order, and you should make sure that the CD, or sometimes it's called optical drive, or removable disks, is at the top, and the hard drive's after that in the boot sequence, and then you've got to save that. It will reboot your machine, and it should work. Now, this is all assuming that the CD is actually bootable. Also, you don't really need to do that if you've got... Do you have a functioning Windows machine at all at this point, Kieran?
Well, the machine is... it gets to where you can log in, and then if I try and log in, it shuts down and restarts.
Okay.
It won't let me log in
right.
if you want to count.
Right. So, I mean, the thing about Ubuntu, if you could get to be installed and download and start the CD from inside Windows, you can actually. Well, no, you're still gonna have to have the boot sequence be the CD. No, I don't think so. I think
you can start it from a USB drive as well.
Yeah.
It says F9 for boot order.
Yes.
And I selected to and I clicked on the CD
sure.
/ CD-ROM, CD/DVD drive.
Yes.
One on there, and then it just started Windows normally for some reason, even though I selected.
I think what's going on is it's not finding a bootable partition on that CD. I think that CD is not actually bootable for your Windows machine, and that's probably what's going on. Miles, would you assume?
Yeah, I don't know for sure.
I think at this point you want to make sure you get a good Ubuntu disk. Where are you located? Are you in Santa Cruz?
Yeah, on the disk.
Let's see. Let me see if we can help you out for a second, Kieran. I think that what we're going to do is we're going to try to get you a disk that actually works. That's going to be your best bet. You know what we do? Can you call us back in just a minute? And let's transfer phone numbers. We'll have Rick transfer phone numbers, and I'll help you out. I'll make a disk for you. That way you can boot from that.
And in other news, you can still get the disk from Canonical. It's the company that makes Ubuntu, but they're not free anymore.
How much they cost?
€5 for a 5-pack.
Cheap.
Awesome.
So, you know.
Maybe I'll buy 5 and I don't have to burn one for Kieran.
Right, but you don't have to worry about like, oh, I lost this one. Well, there's another one. You can give it to friends and family.
All right, Kieran, we'll help you off air. Thank you so much for calling.
Wait, do you think we could drive over to the station and talk to you after the show?
I don't have the disc with me, so it's not going to help you out. But why don't you call back? Let's get our phone numbers transferred. Actually, you just go to my website, lyle.troxel.com. And you'll find out how to contact me.
Or you can go to geekspeak.org.
Send me an email. Give me your phone number, not on air, but on through email, and I will get you worked out. Okay? Thank you so much for calling.
Yeah. Anybody else out there who wants to get Ubuntu, get information, go to our website, go to contact us, and try to get that information to you.
Yeah. All right. Let's go on, I think, to one more call. Maybe we'll get a couple calls today. You know what? Actually, we need a news story. We're not ready. Who's up next? I think it's Ben.
Is it me?
Yeah. Something with ferric fluids or something?
Yeah. This is just a kind of a fun, quick little one. when you're talking about pumping fluids, right, like to either just like, you know, you can use a fan to blow air. To move fluids, it's actually kind of difficult because you have to have these moving parts, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's this new technology that uses ferrofluids instead of just normal fluids. These are fluids that respond to a magnetic pull, right? So a lot of times what it is basically is just some copper filaments or something like that, something that's magnetic suspended in some kind of solution.
How about iron?
Iron, sorry, not so, yeah. Copper. Copper is not. Copper is conductive. Not
all forms of copper. No, copper.
I'm thinking of pennies. No, yeah, never mind.
Copper is really interesting because you can do a lot of things with it.
Pennies aren't made much of copper anymore. They're zinc, actually.
And yeah. So, are you saying carbon or copper?
Well, we learned
said carbon a second ago.
Did I?
Yeah, but in any case, it's not that important.
Well,
ferric means iron.
Iron. Ferris. Okay. There iron we go. There we go. F-E-S We've learned that Ben doesn't remember which magnets or which metals. Anyway, but what they do is they've got this new pumping method, and some potential uses of it would be for cooling things. For example, like your laptop, you've got fans in there, and you're using an air cooling system. So the whole idea behind this pump, though, is that you don't have any moving parts, right? So you don't have any fans or anything like that. And with computers, we've been moving toward that for a long time. You know, now we have solid-state hard drives, which removes the spinning platter of the hard drive. And pretty much at this point, the only things that spin, I think, would just be the optical drive and the fans, right? So if they can move forward with this technology, then we might be able to even make our laptops thinner and also less prone to having issues. So
all right.
It's pretty cool. And I'll post the story with more details on actually how they're doing it. On geekspeak.org.
A couple weeks ago on Geekspeak, we talked about somebody called in with a problem with their DVD player. And the mm-hmm. issue was that halfway through the film, it was starting to stall out. Now, Alex wasn't here, so I'm going to ask Alex. Halfway through the film, it kind of stuttered a little bit, and then it started playing again, or sometimes it wouldn't start playing mm-hmm. again. What do you think that was? We got it wrong.
Blu-ray or DVD?
DVD.
DVD, my guess would be a scratch or dust or fingerprints.
No, good try. Actually, let me give you more information. It happened with multiple discs. It was on the
and always right around the midpoint.
Right around the midpoint.
Damage on the actual head, the laser?
No, kind of.
Oh, kind of.
We got a call.
You
we got
it,
two,
but I don't want to admit it, so I'm going to tell you now.
No, okay. I'll admit that it's definitely about how it reads.
Uh-huh.
The issue is. And what we had said on the air was that it was some software that was kicking in about halfway through the disc, some background tasks. So we got all this software thing, not the problem. The problem actually has to do with dual-layer discs. So a dual-layer disc actually puts the information at two levels. Right, Miles?
Got it.
We got two emails in about this getting corrected. Craig was one of them. I can't remember who that person was. With basically, a dual-layer disc allows more content to be stored. And the reason why we know it was that problem is that self-burn DVDs didn't have this problem, only the store-bought ones, right, which are dual-layer. It's harder. You don't normally do a dual-layer disc self-burn. But in any case, that was the problem, that halfway through the disc about or somewhere in there, the content was switched to the second layer, and the second layer has a different focal point. And, of course, the head wasn't reading the second focal point as well, and there's the problem. So definitely the hardware issue. That's now, it's possible you can clean the lens.
I'm so frustrated with myself
because
I knew that.
Of course we all knew that.
Yeah.
I just don't watch DVDs on my computer anymore.
Well, I mean, I removed my optical drive to put in another hard drive in my MacBook Pro.
That's the problem?
No.
I'm saying good riddance DVDs, you know, but like, bummer, I knew that.
Ugh. We did not know that. See, the thing is, there's so many things that we don't know, and we just try to help each other out and try to fill up the gaps because we are so
I knew it really well. Miles is wrong. Sorry.
And that's exactly why we need people calling in, and we love it when you correct us.
Absolutely.
It's fantastic.
Because we get to learn something, which is really nice.
That's how science works. Yeah.
Get so corrected. Lyle, shall we see if we can not help line three?
We're helping. We help line two. I'm going to help him out. Carlos, what can we not help you with?
Hey, I've got kind of a security question. What I'm planning on doing is I'm kind of just started building like a website for myself.
Okay.
And I wanted to run it through Opera's, you know, like file sharing ability so that I don't have to try and find a host at the moment. But I was just curious as to like the kind of the security issues that go with, you know, file sharing through a web browser.
I don't know what
the I'm file not sure. Is.
Opera has Opera Unite, card. And you can install file sharing. It's an application. Is that what you're talking about?
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I've never actually used it. I was really interested in it, but I use Chrome.
Oh, okay. Oh, Chrome has one. I didn't know Chrome.
Oh, no. I just use Chrome, the browser. I was interested in it, but
it
I don't use
like
Opera.
It looks like Opera Unite, you guys, is very much like Dropbox. So what's happening is Opera, the company behind it, stores files remotely. Depending on how this works, and we don't know a lot about how this works, but... It looks like a system where you choose files on your computer, your software on your computer copies those files to a web server, to a server someplace, and then you can give out the URL to that server. It's safe assuming that you trust the software that is running on your computer that copies them, which you probably do because it's Opera, it's your web browser. And
right.
Secondly, that you choose to share files that you want to have public or pseudo-public. As long as you manage that, yeah, it's totally fine. I don't know if they're going to allow you to do like web serving through that. Also, when you talk about, you know, hosting a website, if you can do free blog services, Tumblr's a great one, right? There's a lot of ways to share content online. If you're talking about large files, that's a different thing. And it's going to – everybody that allows you to share large files online is going to have some kind of way of remediation – of getting money from you because it costs money to host large files. But it's not a lot of money. You can buy, you know, you can get a service – a web service that allows a lot of traffic. I think there's actually even unlimited traffic services for like $5 a month. So not a lot of money. But what I would do is look for one of these kind of free website hosting things because it's just a little easier for you unless you're really into, you know, whipping out the HTML and actually coding it yourself.
Well, a quick question too. What sort of files or what sort of data are you actually looking to have out there to be shared?
Yeah, that's the thing is I wasn't sure how well this would work because I am doing some like PHP stuff, and I don't know if it'll actually handle that because it's probably not using an Apache.
That's right. It won't run PHP files.
Yeah.
That's right.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely not. The file sharing thing really is to get the content back out, not to process the content. PHP is a programming environment that runs on a web server. And the idea is whenever you hit the URL, the web server actually runs code, changes the content. So this would definitely not do that.
Yeah, and if all you're doing is static content, I would also highly recommend just about every ISP, when you have an internet account, provide some space for you to put your content up on. So that's something you're already paying for that most people don't even use.
That's true. Yeah, if you've got an ISP, you probably have space on it. That's right. Very good point.
Oh, I didn't know they did that. Yeah,
also, if you have a Google account, you can create a Google account and have pages there. Now, I don't think they do PHP. I'm not sure if they have any active scripting. But that's another option. And then of course, you can go to some hosting provider, right? Like for some of my clients, I use Bluehost. There's a lot of them out there.
Yeah, that are like $4 a month or something.
Yeah, $7 a month to $4 a month, somewhere in there. So that's another option.
Oh, okay.
There's also a couple of pay-as-you-go services, like Nearly Free Speech, I think, is one of them. And it's like, you know, enable this particular service, PHP or whatever, for like one penny every day or something ridiculously low like that. So there's that option as well.
So I think you're safe from that perspective, Carlos, but I don't think it's going to have your needs met. Thank you for the call.
All right.
Take care. I thought we were going to take like security, like password security call. I'm kind of bummed.
You wanted to do another password show, didn't you?
We've talked enough about passwords.
Miles, what's going on with Kindle?
Very fascinating news. I was very excited to hear that Kindle eBooks will soon be available to borrow from 11,000 U.S. libraries.
Whoa.
In other words, go to a library, they will have WhisperSync be able to synchronize to your Kindle to make that book available, and you'll have that book. They haven't specified exactly how long, but somewhere between a week and a week or two. That you would have the book checked out, and then it disappears from your Kindle.
Okay, wait. So it's your Kindle. You're not getting a Kindle. You're getting books for your Kindle from the library.
The e-books, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I thought you meant they were putting 11,000 units of Kindles into libraries, and then you get to borrow a Kindle. So you get to do library checkout books in your Kindle. That's awesome.
Well, also keep in mind, I'm sure you can use your iPad or every other device.
Kindle app users,
Kindle
app users too. So how is this working? They're actually giving some kind of service to libraries where libraries can approve books to be loaned?
Yeah, and
it's pretty cool.
You go to that participating public library's website. I have to check to see if Santa Cruz has that. If I have to check before the show. And then you're basically checking them out through Amazon. In other words, they have a connection to Amazon. You do the checkout, and
so you have to be on a computer to do it. Can I do it right now from my Kindle?
It transfers actually over WhisperSync.
So you have to go to the library.
But I have to go to the. I have to physically go to the library.
Yeah.
Oh.
WhisperSync is local.
Oh wait, no.
No,
you find the books on the public library's website.
Oh.
And then you would check them out through
with your library card
through something through Amazon. Interesting. Yeah.
Okay, we got to Ben. Since you got the guy with the Kindle, would you research this and check out a book from a library and tell us in a couple months when you figure out how to do it?
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. It'll take me a couple months.
I knew your answer was me. Yeah. Let's say that astronauts go completely blind in space. That's just what happens. Is there any other way we can get data from the human brain back and forth without eyes?
Sure. There's actually some interesting research.
You have the worst segue. So, I didn't know earlier. You just noticed the bad ones.
That's confirmation bias.
Yeah, well, basically some research has been going on where they're trying to reconstruct basically create a video of what a person is looking at based on recorded brain activity.
Awesome.
I'll put up a link because they actually have a YouTube video showing what the person was actually being stimulated with and what they were watching and what the reconstruction did. And it's frightening.
I've seen some of this stuff with like a 12-pixel by 12-pixel ability. So if it gets more interesting than that, I mean, that's fantastic.
Just think dream recorders and recording what your brain sees. Talk about spying on people. Their own eyeballs.
Spying on people with their own eyeballs. Fantastic.
Wow.
Geeks Beyond KOSP is supported by home and small business tech, providing IT support to businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and business tech specialize in protecting data and have been providing data, storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission.
Court-appointed special advocates. Oh, my goodness. Court-appointed special advocates.
And Miles finally messed up. Yes.
Court-appointed special advocates seeks volunteers to provide support, guidance, and a voice in court for children who have been removed from their homes because they were victims of abuse or neglect. Those interested in becoming a volunteer advocate can attend an informational orientation. Regularly scheduled North County orientations are held the first Tuesday of the month, and South County orientations are held the third Wednesday of the month. Details and RSVP are at 831-761-2956 or by email at danielle@casaofsantacruz.org.
The geeks today were Miles Elam, who was just speaking, Alex Lias, and Ben Jaffe. My name's Lyle Troxell. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. I want to mention that everything we talk about today is available for more information and links and videos and all that stuff up at geekspeak.org. GeekSpeak is Creative Commons endeavor. Share and share alike.
And is a registered service mark of David Lawrence, and we thank the Puppet Master for its usage.
I said that already, though.
Oh, you did? Okay,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I never listened to you anyway. Now, at the same time, here's a quick little bit for the very end, which is, are you aware when you listen to a good piece of music and your skin tingles and you get your hair standing on end?
Oh, yeah.
It's actually called music-evoked frisson. And it is because of the 3 to 4 kilohertz range, and opera singers practice getting that range. Mm.